Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy NBA Draft Week.
Woo! Yeah, the NBA Draft is already kind of a twisting, turning labyrinth of things going on for Syracuse players in particular. Malachi Richardson's gone from off the board to, you know, possible top 10 pick. Michael Benajay's gone from off the board to potential late first pick. I feel like Malachi's probably going to end up around 15. I feel like Benajay's probably going to end up somewhere around 40, if I had to guess.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, we've heard about the potential promise that Malachi got from Memphis, reportedly, which Dante Green will tell you might not necessarily be like 100% real, but I think often those promises end up working out just because, you know, teams, if they have been made, teams don't want to alienate agents and whatnot. And that sounds like about the range where he should go anyway, somewhere in that 15 to 20 range.
You know, maybe, I like the Memphis fit.
Yeah, that'd be a fun fit. I mean, they need scoring in the worst way. He'd probably be relied upon to play in the rotation right away, and they might need like immediate guard help, as you know, as is, just because it sounds like they're going to lose Mike Conley. Obviously, he's a different position than Malachi, but I think there are worse places. Although they do seem to have a little bit of like potential franchise upheaval in the next couple of years.
Oh yeah, I think the grit and grind era is over, and we're definitely looking at a new Memphis, and one that I'm not really sure what it's going to turn into. I know the Knicks had originally been looking at Mike Conley. I think that ship has sailed after today's news, unfortunately. But I think a lot of other things open up for him elsewhere, whether it's San Antonio, which seems like it's going to be freeing up some cap space. Dallas is freeing up a ton, even if Dirk does come back, and I think he will. Don't know about Darren Williams and Chandler Parsons. So I think Dallas could be a potential landing spot. I mean, a lot of teams have salary cap space, and a lot of teams, especially when it's like a two-player draft, don't necessarily want to wait to rely on some of these guys who in most years would probably be outside the lottery, you know, to round into rotation guys.
Yeah, so that's where you get like all the intrigue of like Boston at three, who seem to be doing everything they can to not have to draft there, even if it means shipping out the three pick for Gordon Hayward, who's a nice player. Probably not one that would usually warrant the three pick considering his contract, but the three pick just doesn't have the value this year. Like, the three pick this year is like what, like maybe an eight or a nine would be in, you know, heavier years. So, NBA offseason, like, it comes real fast, just like legitimately on the heels of the finals. And even without like the, you know, people were obviously the Durant watch is on, even though I really struggle to see him doing anything but signing a 1-year extension in Oklahoma City.
He can't leave. Not after what
happened.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make sense. Next year, maybe. And then, obviously, LeBron kind of shut down all the speculation about him, which, you know, if you thought he was going to leave after 2 years back, like, I think you were, I don't know what you were thinking. Like, even LeBron, who defies, you know, conventional wisdom pretty often, couldn't imagine that happening, even if they hadn't won the finals. So, yeah, that's fun, and it's great to see the Syracuse guys involved. Obviously, Melo seemed to be involved in the Derrick Rose stuff. Apparently, he contacted Rose last week. Now you have Benajay climbing draft boards. I don't know. I mean, who's allowed? I don't know how they enforce that. That was a report from someone that he reached out to Rose.
I thought that was collusion.
You know. Well, sure.
I guess if he was a free agent, it'd be more of a problem.
True. I mean, I guess it might have been like a, you know, if we do this, are you interested feeler thing. Clearly, Chicago was, you know, working on it already. I don't think this thing happened like this morning.
Oh, yeah. And Melo had always wanted to play with him for a while now. I mean, a couple years ago when he was thinking free agency, Chicago. I think Chicago's always been near the top of his list if he was going to play somewhere besides the Knicks. And I think part of that was Rose. I don't know if it's Rose in his current form, but, you know, I think this is one of those kind of... I told you beforehand, like when we were talking about it this afternoon, like I don't love what was given up for him, especially because it's a, you know, this is the last year of his deal, but I think the Knicks could potentially, if Rose can play at a better level than he did last year, even if he doesn't hit his MVP season levels, I think that he can still, you know, help push the Knicks kind of over the hump and into that 40 to 45 wins range, assuming that Porzingis, you know, grows as projected, and assuming that this team can also grab another piece in free agency, especially now to replace Robin Lopez.
Yeah, I'm obviously not a Knicks fan. I think it's a decent move, if only because Robin Lopez is a nice player. I don't know that he was going to be the building block of a championship team. Jerian Grant like could develop into a really nice player, but I'd say odds are he is probably a role player, just based on like the odds of like any player developing into a star. And with Rose, you know, I'd say what's there, like a 15% chance he like suddenly becomes the player he was. Maybe that's even too high. But even if he's what he was last year and stays healthy and puts in chips in like what 16 and 7-ish, you know, that's a solid upgrade over Calderon. And if not, if it's a total disaster, the fact that now you're out from under Robin Lopez and Calderon and you can dump Rose after a year, you can kind of commit to either, you know, building around the triumvirate of Anthony, Rose, and Porzingis and whoever else you add, or you have a pretty easy out now to just scrap everything and start rebuilding around Porzingis and going that direction. So I think it might actually give the Knicks some flexibility in the long term, or, you know, maybe the Knicks just become a kind of like middling, you know, mid-playoff tier Eastern Conference team, which you can argue whether or not that's what fans want.
I think we'll just take the playoffs at this point. I know everyone forgets that, you know, a few seasons ago we were the 2 seed in the East, but it did happen. And we were actually pretty good that season, and before the Warriors showed up, we set the single season record for 3s. But it hasn't been that long, but I think because of just the continued failures, it feels like it's been forever. I think you're right, though. I think that gives the Knicks more options. I think Lopez wasn't like a burdensome contract, if only because I thought he was a good piece at the 5. But beyond that, yeah, I'd say if you're going to ship out $13 million for him, I think Calderon was up to 8 in his entire
year. Something like that.
And then Grant was probably was just outside the lottery, so he's probably hanging around, what, like 1.3?
Yeah, somewhere like between 1 and 3. I don't know how the I don't know exactly where he was, but couldn't have been that much. But yeah, he's the one. Like, if Grant blows up and turns into like an all-star, then it doesn't look good. But the odds of that happening are pretty low.
Yeah, I mean, he could, and I think my one hesitation I told you was like Grant in a deal, fine. Lopez in a deal, fine. But if it's both, seems weird. When I feel like Lopez could have been shipped for, on his own, for Rose or a rotation guy, or like a, you know, higher rotation guy, or I feel like you could get rid of Grant for, you know, an early second. So yeah, I would have preferred those options, but nonetheless, you know, it is what it is. I don't think the Knicks are done. I don't think the Bulls are done. I think there's a lot of teams that, given the amount of money that can be thrown around this summer and how shallow the class is that we're in for a very wild, wild and confusing bit of spending.
Yeah, I'm excited for tomorrow. I mean, just based on today, there was that trade. There was a 3-way deal between Atlanta, Utah, and Indy, where George Hill got shipped to Utah. Now they have like 8 point guards, and
so they're the Timberwolves.
And T got shipped. Well, they have to get rid of someone. Trey Burke's probably done. Who knows if not? They got some. And then the Pacers acquired Jeff Teague, which is a nice move for them. And I think Atlanta got the 12th pick.
Yes.
So now they have 12 and 21. They could package that into something bigger, like, or they could, someone else is speculating they might dump them both to free up potential room to re-sign Al Horford, because they don't want to pay the rookie deals, which is kind of a weird reason to acquire the 12, but sure. So a lot of moving parts. I think tomorrow might be kind of crazy. I think last year was pretty boring on draft night, if I remember correctly. There was a lot of like speculation and not much happened trade-wise, or am I misremembering that?
I believe you're correct. The year before, there was a lot going on.
Yeah. So this year, it seems like the NBA is like, I think we've kind of moved in the, like, we're in like the post-tanking era now, because I think Philly was like the grand experiment for the whole league, and that clearly, whether or not you think they were doing the right thing, which I think you can make arguments on either side, clearly the fans, a large segment of the fans weren't happy. Another segment isn't happy that they strapped it like midway through, And it kind of worked because they were going to have Ben Simmons, but it kind of didn't because they just had they didn't make a lot of forward progress. So it seems like the league is like kind of done with the idea of like the full multi-year tank. So now you may be making the playoffs and just trying to hang around, like, and just trying to be in contention in case something happens is now going to be the new vogue again, which is interesting.
Yeah, and you know, I'm all in favor of it. I think the more meaningful basketball at the end of the season, the better. I've always been a big fan of the Bill Simmons theory of the teams that don't make the playoffs have to play in a tournament, and the winner gets the first pick. That was always just a fun theory for me, and it's one that I would still support. But yeah, I do think if we're going to move away from this heavy tank, I mean, I still think that the Lakers are the only team that could still pull it off. I think even the Knicks have such a... The fan base is so fragile, and the fan base is just so easily aggravated that I just don't think... Like, we had a one-year tank, and then we, you know, went back to being a middling team. I think that with the Lakers, they're the only fan base that can survive it, if only because they have other things to do during the season if they're not watching games. I feel like every other fan base, yeah, would absolutely revolt. And that's what you're seeing from the Sixers, and I think you see from maybe the post-Steve Nash Suns and some other teams that have kind of... And the Timberwolves, too. Teams have been hanging around there for quite some time.
Yeah, and I think there's also, like, with the big city fan bases, like, there's just so many... Like you said, there's so much else happening, and there's also, like, a fair bit of, like, fair-weatheriness there where, you know, if someone isn't a diehard... you know, Laker fan, maybe they pick up the team and they're watching every game when they're good, but otherwise it's just, you know, whatever. It's not a huge loss to them. So, and the Knicks fan have just been beaten into submission. So they're just, if good things happen, I think they'll take them. But if not, I think you're just going to, you know, the status quo is what it is. So people aren't too, going to be too broken up at this point because it's been so bad aside from a couple of years ago when they had that 50-win year. So, I don't know. I'm not a Nets fan. I'm a Nets fan, as we've covered in this podcast many times before, but I don't have any, like, particular disdain for the Knicks. So, it would be, I think it would be fun to be in the city if they were good. I would just hope my team finds its way out of the endless gutter sooner than later. And that's a whole other story, because who knows how they go about doing that.
Fair enough. Moving to actual Syracuse things, I know, like, we started Syracuse-ish, and then we ended up going into a Knicks, Nets, and Grizzlies cast. Dr. Gross decided to follow me out to Los Angeles. How about that? He didn't get the Davis job. That was not surprising, to be honest. Yeah, now he's at Cal State Los Angeles, and I'm looking forward to seeing the rebranded taxis soon.
All right, so because I legitimately could not think of this when it happened. Are they D1? Or, I know they're obviously not.
They are, FBS, not, they are, but... not D1.
Ooh.
They don't even have football.
Oh, so he sounds like a good job for Dr. Gross. They're the Golden Eagles.
I was hoping they were the Screaming Eagles, but nope, they're the Golden Eagles.
How quickly does Dr. Gross say that he intends to elevate them to Division I? First press conference?
You know, he kind of implied it already.
Oh, that's amazing. What'd he say?
Well, because he inherited this job from his old boss at USC, Mike Garrett. And Garrett says, you know, he did all these things, and then Gross comes in right away with the messaging about how he's going to continue to elevate the program. And, like, he doesn't say it, but, like, you get the feeling. And to be honest, the fact that there's only three D1 institutions, depends on how you define them. There's a few more than that. There's UCLA and USC, obviously. There's LMU, which is D1 in basketball. Pepperdine, also D1. And then you have, like, a couple other, like, schools just, like, kind of hanging around. So you got, like, your UC Riversides, and, like, if you go a little bit further south, you've got, you know, you've obviously got the Orange County teams. But who else is around? Because I guess Riverside's not really LA area either. You've got a couple other programs. But, yeah, like, Cal State, LA, and, like, Cal State Long Beach is obviously, like, kind of the, at least in LA County, like, the pinnacle of the Cal State schools, you know, and it's kind of on that next rung underneath San Jose, Fresno, and San Diego. So, yeah, I mean, Cal State LA could become, they just don't have the student body or the campus or anything like that, but I don't know. Maybe he decides to turn Cal State LA into LA's college team or something similar.
I really hope that he like just goes real big to start, just as it'll be fun to watch from afar. And also, I'm reading their Wikipedia page, and the one thing that jumps out at me is that their athletic facility is named after Billie Jean King. So you can prepare for that to become the Billie Jean King Heroes Sports Complex, or Legends Sports Complex. Because, you know, why name something after a pure person when you can name something after a person and then a unnamed other group?
He name dropped her in his intro presser.
Did she go there?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
It's better.
It's not just like they randomly named something after Billie Jean King.
It's like, yeah, whatever. Let's just, that's like all those New York high schools named after JFK and George Washington.
Just like, hey, Sam Elliott went there. They should name something after Sam Elliott's mustache.
Yeah, like the football team.
Oh, this is going to be fun. We need to keep an eye on the good doctor going forward.
It'll be easy from here, actually. I might just start like a spinoff blog.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Gross is an absolute pediatrician.
Dr. Gross is an absolute, he's something.
Yeah, Dr. Gross is an absolute something, and then it just chronicles the Cal State LA Eagles, and their preponderance to D1 that I decide based on quote unquote sources to start discussing.
You're gonna be the West Virginia dude of Cal State Los Angeles. Of D2 schools in the greater LA area.
It's realignment, man, you don't even know.
It's a real realignment. It's that pure shit.
The California Collegiate Athletic Conference is dead.
Oh, God.
Anyway. In other Syracuse staffing news, Mackie McPherson's coming back, barring admission, which I don't really think is a question. He's the grandson of a legend and went here anyway.
Yeah, and I'm sure he had pretty good grades considering his brother is like a 4, like, just like a 5.0 GPA or something crazy, so I'm sure Mackey's at least kind of in that realm.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be any question about whether he qualifies. I think that's... It's awesome for him to come back. I know I wasn't a huge fan of seeing him on NC State's sideline.
And what, Louisiana Tech before that?
Yeah, it was La Tech. Which, you know what? I think that is something I think everybody needs in their coaching story is a little bit of... Even if it's for a year, that like...
Everyone needs to make a trip to Ruston.
But yeah, like the middle of nowhere, like this sucks, and the cap on this is what's it called? The Royal Purple Las Vegas Bowl. Like,
they were pretty good. Like,
they were pretty
honestly,
good.
Honestly, you could do worse than learning under noted former rival coach Skip Holtz.
Roll damn Holtz. I mean, the guy said we've
talked. I think
about
we talked
this.
About this. One yeah, of the like, weirdest coaching careers.
Yeah, one of the weirdest coaching careers, and when he takes over the Tennessee job. It's going to be great.
Can't wait.
And then I guess our last bit of Syracuse thing before we get away from Syracuse things, as we normally do. Recruiting. It's been really busy. We've had 3 recruits in the last 4 or 5 days. A lot of wide receivers in this class. We've got 3 out of 6 so far. Dan, how many more do you think we can add, especially knowing that some of the guys that Tommy DeVito in particular wants to add are in that wide receiver or running back mold?
It's hard to know because we haven't seen a full Babers class, but it seems like we're going to be using more wide receivers at the very least. So you know, getting the numbers up there is probably important. And also, like the receivers fit very specific roles in this offense, even more so than the offenses we've run before. So a guy like we just brought in from St. Thomas Aquinas, Josh Palmer, he's like 6'3". People think he can fill out a little bit. He's going to be more of a flanker, where the other two, their names are both escaping me. But we just
wait. Let me. We got Nykyme Johnson.
Nykyme Johnson, yeah.
And Sherrod Johnson.
Yes. So Sherrod Johnson's, I think, like 5'11". So he's more like in between. You know, not a total slot guy, but that's probably going to be more of his role. And then Nykyme Johnson Hopefully someone gets us the correct pronunciation there. I think it's probably Nikeem. Sure. He's supposed to be a total burner. He's like 5'9", but he runs like a sub 4.4. I think he clocked in officially at like 4.42 in the opening regional.
That's insane.
And I think he was I saw this, and I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure he was named the wide receiver MVP at that region, the DC regional.
Oh, wow.
So that's really good. I mean, that's not like it's not Florida, but it's not like, you know, Vermont. He I'm sure he had some solid competition there. So,
and he's underrated
everything,
by, I know
he's underrated
Scout,
by, yeah.
But I saw Rivals has him as a three.
Rivals and 24/7 both have him as a three. And like when he committed, I just saw a lot of national guys talking about it. Like he was a guy that was definitely on the radar. So I definitely expect him to be someone that we'll see get bumped in those rankings, which again always shows you how important they are. And then Josh Palmer was like very, very squarely on the radar. He's floating around like top 100 in Florida, which is really good. He's another guy. I mean, he's at St. Thomas Aquinas, which is a huge program.
And a place we actually have a nice pipeline at.
Yeah, we've had like in and out Casulo connections.
Even with Casulo gone, we've managed to continue. I mean, and this is a testament again today to Monroe that he's able to. I mean, we talked about how good George McDonald was, well, quote unquote was, down in Florida, and I feel like since he's left, we've actually like tripled our Florida commits. And you look at the class of 2016 that had what, 7 guys, and now this year's has 2. I'd say we're probably on track for at least 5, if not more. I mean, that's to me that's a great job by a young staff just getting in there and understanding how important Florida is, especially for this program.
Yeah, and targeting guys that aren't going to be, you know, you don't want to spend a lot of time with a guy who's going to go to Florida or Florida State. Like, you, if you think you have a legit shot and he's a big kid, that's fine. But, and eventually you want to aim high. But they seem to be going after these guys who are floating a bit under the radar, just haven't quite blown up, but are still talented players. And in Florida, it's way easier to, you know, there's guys that just don't quite get the attention as others just because there's so many. I mean, there are probably, you know, a few, maybe 250, wide receivers in the state of Florida that can play D1 at some level. It's just, so there are going to be guys that just aren't quite as heavily recruited as they probably should be. And we're being from Florida, while you get all of this exposure as a whole, might not get like the individual attention that, you know, in another state where they dominate and put up crazy numbers, they would. I think with Johnson, either Johnson or Palmer, I forget which one. Actually, it was probably Palmer. I think it was today because he's from the bigger program. Like, he really hasn't had a huge role in the offense yet because he's at St. Thomas Aquinas. You're going to have to wait your turn. You have probably 2 D1 guys ahead of you. So hopefully he has kind of a breakout year this year and Syracuse manages to hang on to him. But they both seem like really good additions, especially considering how explosive Baber's offense purports to be. So
it's good too, because I feel like those types of guys, you know, are the ones that can more easily plug into. It's not always the case, but can more easily plug into a college system and say, hey, like, we got, you know, we have these veteran guys here, like, you know, we want you to be able to wait your turn. And admittedly, like, you think at first, you know, there are a lot of wide receivers on the Syracuse roster, but a lot of them are in their second 2 years of eligibility, and outside of, you know, Brisley, Irv, and Steve Ishmael, there's no one who's really shown a ton yet. I know Dante Strickland got switched over to halfback. You know, obviously there's guys like Jamal Custis and Adley Anoisi, 2 guys who I think were highly lauded when they first came in under Schaefer and have been underused since, who could break out. But yet you look around that roster and even, you know, a guy like Alvin Cornelius, again, guys that they're the back half of their eligibility, there's going to be a huge sweeping shift in this offense, and I think Babers is kind of, you know, getting out ahead of that, especially when he sees that positions like, I'd say, linebacker and offensive line and maybe even running back are already, you know, well accounted for. So I think we might see a bigger stress on you know, D-line, receiver, quarterback in this cycle, especially when we only have probably about 18 scholarships or so to deal with.
Right, and it was also kind of an issue that we, like you said, outside of a very small handful of guys, like we don't know what we have from a couple of guys that we were excited about getting, especially those bigger receivers. So Babers, you know, he doesn't have, obviously everyone knows what Steve Ishmael is. You know, he hasn't put up some huge season yet because he's been limited by the offense, but like quantity. But otherwise, like there's only two or three guys, him, Brizzly, Irv, who, you know, spent most of his career running back. So even if the other guys do pan out, Bayers does need to make sure he has the numbers to run the offense. So I'm not too surprised to see a big influx in receivers because that is so important.
Yeah, and I, like we said, that makes three so far. And I bet we add at least one more. I know there's a couple other targets we were talking to in the last couple weeks. And again, guys that, that Tommy DeVito, the quarterback commit, has been talking about really wanting. So I think we'll see. But either way, I mean, this is going to be an offense built on speed and built on how much, you know, its receivers can stay on the field and make plays and cycle out. And I think having, you know, we're used to having maybe two, you know, decent receivers, maybe one who occasionally breaks through, whether that's, you know, an Alec Lemon or whether it's a Steve Ishmael, or there's always like, I feel like we never have like a full complement of wide receivers who can contribute. And I feel like, if not this year, next year, where we're going to have a very deep group of receivers. And, you know, when Nykeem Johnson committed yesterday, and for those listening on Tuesday, I know Bleacher Report had that that Tavon Austin comparison. And that was, I mean, again, you talk about the speed that you mentioned and the size. It just, he's very shifty. He's very elusive, very hard to take down. And I mean, maybe he's going to have to add a little bit more weight, obviously, at the college level. But nonetheless, it seems like a wrinkle that Babers has had in the past, but not maybe to this level. It'll be very, very cool to see, you know, what a player like that can do, especially playing half his games indoors.
Yeah, I mean, that video they put out, that was actually from like 2 months ago. That was from, I'm not sure if it was that opening camp where he had a big performance, but that wasn't even like prompted by the Syracuse commitment. That was something that someone found. So, but yeah, he, in that video, he looked incredibly just as fast as build, and he also seems to have really nice like fluid movement and isn't like a jerky runner. Like he definitely knows where he's had to, you know, occupy space in the football field and made people miss. So definitely excited to see what he can do. And hopefully we get some fun highlights this fall from him.
Very much agreed. Dan, why don't we talk a little beer? What have you been drinking?
So down in the Philadelphia area this weekend for a bit. So I had a couple of things from friends who live right near the Conshohocken Brewing Company, which is very local in a suburb of Philly. I had their Island in the Sun, which was a very summery IPA, really light. I think they brew it with pineapple. It was actually probably a little even more pineapple-y than the Stolpin, but not overpoweringly so. And then they use a bunch of different hops, but definitely not like too much of a hop bomb. So that was really nice and refreshing. And it was at like 8.9%, which like I had no idea until, you know, after I finished it. It's a really interesting one there. I also had from them, I thought I had more than one thing from them, maybe not, or I forgot to check in. But I also had Ridiculous from Founders, which was definitely like quite hoppy, as the name would tell you, and a 9.5%. Pretty intense, but it was actually way more malty than I thought it would be. Not in a bad way, just like I wasn't expecting that flavor. And they do bill it as like a PA. So that was an interesting one. Founders always does good work. So we had a bomber of that. And then I got to try Goose Island's Experimental Summer, which was quite good, which I hadn't seen up here. So I was glad they picked one of those up. That was probably the hoppiest thing I had this weekend. I think they use like two or three different varieties. And that was definitely the I think that was actually a double. And then I had some Grapefruit Stolpin, some All Day IPA, the normal, the standards. But those were the new things.
Nice. Yeah, I know. For me, I always like I like a single hop beer, but I think anyone on the West Coast, especially, you get conditioned on Stone. where Stone uses like between 7 and 10, like minimum.
All the hops.
Yeah, all the hops, and you just kind of, you get so used to that like kind of dynamic flavor profile, you just kind of gravitate toward it. On my end, I might have mentioned this last week, but Maine Beer Company randomly shows up in LA last week and had a special tapping of lunch at one of my local beer shops. So got to have some fresh lunch in LA, a rare treat. Apparently they'll be back here occasionally. It seems like draft only, no bottles, which bummer, but maybe next time they bring dinner, fingers crossed. So you had Stone Mocha IPA. I think I mentioned it last week. They brewed it for the Liberty Station anniversary last year and now bottled it this year. Very good. Dan, I would highly recommend grabbing some. Definitely has a good balance of kind of chocolate coffee and it's in some hops on the back end.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't really well. I was skeptical when I first tried it last year, but again, definitely delivers. Had Ballast Point's Barmy. It's a kind of apricot golden ale. On the heavier end, I didn't even realize it was like around like 9.5. But still, good beer. I had Vliet from Threes. Very good German-style Pilsner from them. Aaron Goldfarb sent that out this way. So once again, thank you, Aaron. I had... I had... Chocolate Salty Barrels from the brewery. It's a in some parts a brewery joke, in other parts a South Park joke, for those who are familiar with the Chocolate Salty Balls bit from way back in the first 7 to 8 seasons of South Park.
R.I.P. Chef.
R.I.P. Chef indeed. And that was it. As far as new stuff, I was hanging up in Big Bear, so I just kind of brought whatever I had in the fridge. Rather than spend a bunch of money up there on a, not that subpar beer up there, but they have like a couple breweries and they don't make like amazing stuff, so probably just easier to bring whatever I have in my fridge when I go up there. But yeah, that's beer. Which brings us to the American Athletic Conference, Dan. Wavy the wave.
Roll damn wave. The
all day
best team in the sports best non-power conference.
I mean, that sounds like blasphemy, and Houston fans might get a little pissed off, but you know what? I'm all about it. Now,
I mean, Houston didn't hire Willie Fritz this offseason.
For nothing.
It's no, like they have a coach or something.
Almost. Tom Herman will be elsewhere soon.
Houston's never been in the SEC.
Ain't played nobody.
Tulane played somebody once, back in the 60s.
Tulane used to play people all the time. They were in the SEC.
They and LSU were rivals, my uncle has told me.
Long time. Yeah. Tulane is a very storied program, and I've seen them play live. I mentioned this before, that I saw the Sean King team back in the 90s against Army, and it got ugly for the Black Knights, but... Nonetheless, Tulane's fun. They got a cool history. We have a fun relationship with them online because for some reason Dan and I started talking about them on a regular basis and got on Fear the Waves radar. So that's been fun. Athlon, who I do buy their magazine, they say Tulane's going 2-10. I say that's blasphemy. I'd say that you'd be hard-pressed to find 8 losses on the schedule just because of the amount of parity that is in the American Athletic Conference after probably that top 4. But Dan, feel free to doubt me there.
It's tough to know because like the American had such a weird season last year, like in a good way for them. But you're relying on like Houston to maintain its level, which it's kind of like a, you know, if you've just watched the games, you're like, oh yeah, Houston was awesome. They lose, you know, some stuff, but they still have Brett Ward and they still have Tom Herman. So they should be really good. But then you, if you're a Bill Connelly devotee, which I generally consider myself, you know, his numbers are like very skeptical of them being quite as good as they are. Although then you watch them like drub Florida State. So I kind of don't know where I fall in there.
The bowl game spike, though, it always happens. And I'm on board with you, both in terms of following Bill and in terms of believing in Houston. But yeah, I think that there's always a team like Houston every year. And, you know, maybe, and funny enough, we talk about the bowl game spike. I mean, go back to last week when we were talking Mountain West. You know, Boise State was coming in the season ranked top 20. And then look what happened there. And that, I felt like the same thing with them. They were returning a lot of pieces too. I don't think Houston can fall off to that level, if only because I think that they have more, just more talent. They're out recruiting Boise State. And
they're out recruiting like us. So,
well, yeah.
They're out recruiting a lot of people. They have like, and they signed a 5-star last year.
Didn't he leave?
No, he's there. Oh. He signed.
There you go.
They had a couple of, I think they had a 4-star as well, and I think he ended up with like Texas or something. But they're recruiting like legitimate, like blue chip talent. Not like a ton of it, but they're the guys in the city of Houston. They are getting after, and they are, you know, making a case for, which is crazy because, you know, generally when you have that gap between the Power Five and the Group of Five, like it's hard to bridge it. And they're doing it. So
unless you're located in one of the most talent-rich areas of the entire country, and the closest program is coming apart at the seams, hi Kevin Sumlin, how are you?
Yeah, and then you have the issues at Texas, which actually don't even seem that bad anymore, and you have now the issues at Baylor, which seem worse than they probably are even publicly acknowledged as. So it's a good time for Houston to do this because right now you have, you know, TCU as the most stable, successful program in the state. And they're, you know, still kind of I wouldn't say it's probably not fair to call them a upstart program at this point because they've been good for a while, but you don't know if they're going to maintain like the Big 12 almost champion level status that they've had the last couple of years.
I buy it. Top 15.
They could because Gary Patterson's awesome. Yeah. But, you know, Boykins, Dawn, et cetera, a lot of their main weapons are gone. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good time for Houston to strike like this. And then they also managed to not have Georgia or USC, probably two of the top 10, conservatively, top 10 jobs in the country, go after Tom Herman. I mean, I think South Carolina went after him a little bit, and he, you know, that's easier to turn down. But then, like, Georgia just seemed like they 1,000% wanted Kirby Smart, and they got him, and more power to him. He's working out well so far. USC just did USC things, so even though Tom Herman's a California native, they didn't seem to even give him a phone call, at least
that's
as far as
we know.
Because
he doesn't have a USC degree.
No, he has never been there. Probably, I mean, he didn't study at USC. How would you ever win football games there? The unique challenges of winning at the most prominent program in the Pac-12, how can any good football coach that hasn't been there before do it? USC is really stupid when it comes to hiring.
To be honest, I feel like I could win six games there.
I'm beginning to think that you, and this even with the Dr. Gross thing, I think that USC people just hate interviewing. They just, for whatever reason, that school has like a very no interview policy. So
no, you know why? It's because their network is so strong out here that they don't have a need to interview. So then when you want to interview them, they're so appalled.
But they're like, why interview? We know Daryl. Daryl will be great. Okay.
We're industry people. We went to USC.
Why interview when you can just look in your alumni directory and pull out an?
Yeah,
it's for the best. Plays here. Just you don't want to make someone move.
Yeah, that's, you know, when Clay is coaching Western Kentucky in 2 years.
Lynn just got a golf membership out here. I mean, he's going to be here all the time anyway. Might as well hire him to lead our athletic department.
Whatever Lynn does, I'm sure it'll be better than the last guy who...
I now realize we just did this exact same bit last week.
Yeah, the same exact bit.
And we haven't even talked about the Pac-12 yet. So, yeah. So USC probably should have tried to hire Tom Herman. So now, like, I was wondering about this today. If Charlie Strong gets it together, which is not off the table, I still kind of believe in Charlie Strong. I think he's a good coach. Texas has some unique challenges, and I
Texas
think
Texas just snagged what's his name from Baylor,
the Duvernay, the really good receiver.
Yeah,
yeah, that was huge for them. And Charlie Strong had a really fun celebration. So, if Charlie Strong turns it around, what's Tom Herman's move? Does he wait for, like, maybe Urban up at Ohio State?
No, A&M.
Does,
like, someone's getting fired this year anyway.
Maybe A&M, but, like, is A&M net, like...
You don't even have to change your brand. You just say own.
You just
city.
Move, like, 40 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess A&M's not a bad move. Like, that's still a big... But, like, I feel like I'd almost feel like I missed out because USC and Georgia were so set on their hires. Maybe you just wait on USC again. But, like, I'd rather be at both of those schools. Yeah, because, like, USC could open up in 2 years.
Well, no, then obviously Sark's coming back.
Sark's good. Sark's cleaned it up. He's coming back. Maybe Lane. Maybe. Maybe Lane, after getting probably a second national championship as the OC at Alabama, they're like, Lane knows how to do this now. He's good.
Lane knows how to do this, but let's have Pete Carroll as his OC just in case.
That's a retirement gig.
Oh, God. It's the USC and Texas podcast. I don't know how this happened.
You've been trumped, Tulane. You're out. Awful.
No, they'll come back. I think you're right, though. I think Herman's move... I don't think Herman's move is Texas. I feel like Herman's move is... I think it's got to be A&M. I don't know where else you go. Maybe... Not even Oklahoma State, right? Like, I don't think that's...
No, you don't go to Oklahoma State. You can do way better. You do Oklahoma.
I think Stoops has solidified himself. I think Fire Stoops train was ready to go before last season started, and now Stoops is fine, and now Oklahoma's fine again. I think that most of the SEC programs are also too conservative to hire him.
He hasn't coached in the SEC before, and he has never coached for Nick Saban, the one golden guy.
Mostly.
I'm going to make a bold prediction, though, and no matter where Herman ends up next, I'm going to predict that Tom Herman is the next head coach at Ohio State. I think whenever Urban Meyer retires, he'll be the heir to that throne.
Yeah, I buy that. It's not like Urban hangs on to his assistants like for a long time. He lets them fly.
No, and they love him up there. Like, you looked at the drop off in the offense from 14 to 15. Like, I think Tom Herman's stock went way up between what he did at Houston and just Ohio State. Like, by the end of the year, they were obviously really good, and they figured it out with Barrett, but, like, it just wasn't the same team for, like, 8 weeks in the post-Herman era. So I bet that'll happen, but maybe that's, you know, who knows how long. Urban to retire after next year, Urban to coach another 10 years, you never really know with him.
Yeah, I'm giving him 5.
Sounds about right.
So, yeah, I mean, Herman, the thing is with Houston, Houston's in a unique situation, because they are a large public school in an oil-rich city with a lot of old rich alums, football history, to be honest.
Like a solid one for like what they are.
Yeah, a really solid one. And they do have the bankroll to keep him from every school except for the top half of the Big Ten, the entire SEC, and maybe 4 teams in the Big 12. Like, most Power 5 schools have to battle more than that to keep their coach. So I think Houston's in a unique situation that if they want to keep Herman and if Herman wants to keep them, I think that, you know, we might revisit if we're a couple Fiesta Bowls down the road with him, that, you know, suddenly 5 years doesn't really seem like that long of a time. And if he's just racking up wins down at Houston, you know, it's a perfect fit for what he would want to do, what Ohio State would want to do. But again, a lot of speculation.
Yep. Why else do we have this podcast? If not to talk about Tulane and speculate wildly and make fun of USC.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously Houston's a well-situated program, and I think that they're the best-situated program in the Western Division by a considerable margin. And the East is a little bit more parity. I think you've got... You've got the resurgent Bulls. I think that USF, who does face Syracuse this year, went from, you know, Willie Taggart on the hot seat to Willie Taggart is going to lead this team to the Orange Bowl in record time. I think Temple is another, you know, you and I always talk about jobs that, you know, we thought would be open. We thought guys would jump. They didn't this past offseason, despite how many openings there were. I think it's because there were a lot of dysfunctional openings, probably more than normal. Matt Rooley is a guy who you figured would jump and didn't, and maybe now he doesn't. I don't, you know, without like thinking about what jobs open up soon, it just doesn't seem like he's on the radar to leave just yet. Then obviously Cincinnati, you know, Tommy Tuberville, I feel like always has one foot out the door anywhere he is. But Cincinnati is now in like year 10 or so of, probably more at this point, like 10 to 12, of what's become a very solid, you know, bowl game or bowl game at bare minimum program, which is pretty awesome for them. And I think the Bearcats should be the best team in the division in the East, but yet for like the third straight year, they aren't.
Yeah, Cincinnati, I think they're the most reliable team. They have Tuberville, who's just a really proven commodity at coach. They have Dunner Keel, who came on really nicely when he wasn't being concussed every week. The main issue for them is that they lose like their entire complement of receivers, which is a really nice group last year. I think their top five receivers are all gone, which is pretty crazy. So that's a little bit to overcome, but when you have a talented quarterback, obviously it makes up for it a bit. I'm just like, USF I really like on paper, and obviously they came on super strong last year, unfortunately beginning with the Syracuse game, and they bring back a lot of those key pieces. It just seems like almost might be a little bit of a regression candidate just based on how strong they came and how they were profiled come beginning of the season.
Everybody's back.
But everyone's back, and like on paper that means, you know, oh, this they build on the 8-win year and now turn it into something, but we've seen in that go, you know, we've seen teams plateau with that profile all the time. But on paper, I think they should be the favorite because they were, I mean, they were awesome at the end of the year. Temple, kind of the same thing. Like, they were really good last year, but I think they won a couple, like, really tight games, and by the end of the year, people had kind of figured them out. Obviously, they played Notre Dame real tough, but after that, they finished losing 3 of 6. Not to anyone bad. I mean, it was USF, you know, drubbed them, but USF was rolling. They played Houston tight at Houston, but, you know, 9-point victory for the Cougars. And then Toledo beat them pretty badly. Toledo's a really nice team, but, you know, people had high hopes for Temple in that game. So I'm not sure if, like, if they're a regression candidate. It just seems like something has to give at the top of this league. And it definitely, because Houston's over on the other side, like the East, it seems like as a whole, it's unlikely that they all play at the level that they did at the end of last year.
Right. Yeah, like you're not going to have 5, you know, 8-win teams again. That's 5 8-win teams without Cincinnati winning 8 games.
Yeah, and then obviously Navy, like, Navy's going to do what it does, but they don't have their all, they don't have Keenan Reynolds down, and Keenan Reynolds was awesome. Like, he was an incredible player that deserved all the accolades he got. So, like, they should take a pretty justifiable step back.
Yeah, and you know what? There's no shame in that, and I think that's...
Oh, yeah, they're in the West. That's so stupid. Navy's in the West. Hey.
Well, Navy wanted to be in the West.
What?
Because they recruit so much from Texas.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. It's still dumb.
I agree. But who else would you put in the West? Cincinnati? That's that would create divisional imbalance.
Basically, like, none of it makes a lot of sense. Like, everyone... No one in the East would make a lot of sense. I guess Cincinnati would make the most. So, sure. I guess Navy can be in the West.
Yeah. And since they're the Naval Academy, I'll give them that request. I think, you know, Navy obviously knows what it's doing. It knows who it is, and it has more resources than the other two service academies by way of an actual athletic department that actually functions to make money and have a budget and be successful. Air Forces is successful, but not via the same avenues, and Army just doesn't have the money, despite having a very large fan base, for obvious reasons. It's the nearest option for downstate New Yorkers. And yes, that is a Rutgers knock. And I think that, you know, you go there, you see the pageantry of it. I mean, I've been to Mishy Stadium, and I think it's a great place to catch a game. But yeah, I just don't think Army has the ability to catch up with Navy at this point based on what Navy is able to do and the conference money that they can take in. Being in the American Athletic Conference, I mean, they're lapping the other group of five conferences. But what we're seeing now, I think, you know, everyone's kind of buying into, okay, like here's another season with, you know, 4 or 5 8-win teams. And I feel like we thought that about the Mountain West just a couple years ago, and now look, the Mountain West is like a 2-deep league. you know, the American could regress. I don't know if they'll regress that steeply, but there are a couple programs that just could do poorly this year. I mean, SMU, probably not going to do too great. UCF, same deal. I mean, East Carolina gambled pretty hard this offseason. UConn kind of loaded up on some easier wins last year. Again, our beloved Tulane gambled, but probably gambled well in the long term. And even Tulsa, you know, another team that maybe you could make the case lucked out. Like, there's a lot of case to be made that this could easily split itself in two and become, you know, 5 to 6 haves and 5 to 6 have-nots.
Yeah, the one thing I will say is this league overall has made just some brilliant coaching moves. It's almost like it's like the smaller version of what the ACC did this year, and obviously the ACC would actually have to prove it, like the AAC has. But obviously you have Herman doing Houston, which has been awesome. Rule at Temple has worked out really well, and like Temple just shouldn't be as good as they are. Memphis obviously now has to deal with losing Fuente, but I thought they made a nice hire in Norville. But then even at the bottom, like SMU, it's going to take them a bit, but I think Morris is them in the right direction. They're at least, you know,
Morris is the right coach,
scoring some points. They'll have him around for a while. UCF, they might still be at the bottom of that league next year because I'm assuming that a Scott Frost offense takes a little while to get, you know, rolling. But at least, you know, it's an interesting direction. You know what you are. You have access to a ton of talent. He's going to it'll probably be an in-and-out job for him just to prove that he can build a program and solve that offense because no one's really done it with the Oregon offense anywhere else before.
He's just going to wait for what's his name to get fired over at Nebraska.
Riley, yeah, I mean, that's the obvious
one. Which could be this year.
It could be this year, but I think, I mean, people are really high in Nebraska because they lost like 3 or 4 coin flip games last year, and the West seems kind of like weird because no one expects Iowa to do what they did again, and Nebraska, it seems like they're going to like either have a really nice year or totally flame out.
7-6.
Put you down for that. And then obviously Tulane with Willie Fritz, like that's a very different identity than anyone else in this league. Even obviously Navy has their option, but the Georgia Southern option isn't quite the same animal. So you have this really interesting array of just different strategies, and it makes for a very fun league, even when there is, like you said, that really distinct cutting point between the two.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's a good point to make, that this league has become a lot of fun. I mean, I'm glad we're not a part of it.
Oh, yeah, would never want to be in it. But fun from the outside.
That'd be miserable. Yeah, fun from the outside. And like, you know, the makeup of it's just odd in general. I mean, you have 3 incredibly large state schools, Houston, USF, UCF. You have 3 private schools. You have 1 service academy. You have a rising team in Memphis and Temple too, really, that kind of timed the jump correctly. Then you've got this like kind of stalwart in Cincinnati, and you've got the team that wants out in Connecticut. And that leaves out Eastern Carolina, but East Carolina, it also has a pretty nice history, in its football program. And you know, they're only about 20 years removed from a top 10 ranking and all these other things. Like, there's a lot to like about every team here, and you know, we talked about it with CUSA, that they were banking on future brands, and I don't think those future brands are going to come the way they thought they were going to. American Athletic Conference bought on brands, it bought on history, and it bought on resources all at once, and I actually think that it's worked out even... I think it worked out, to be honest, better than the Big East Football Conference did, despite the fact that those programs might have had more in common on paper.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, when you make good hires across the board, it's things work out well. And obviously, like I said before, the ACC has kind of done the same thing at a much bigger, more, you know, a higher level. But if they, I'm laughing because of an edit that a recruit just, I'm going to retweet this, and you're going to see it and laugh, and I'm not going to give any context to the listeners.
That's fine.
We're hoping. I'll give some context. There's a player who just committed to South Carolina, and
he goes to Vagos Prep,
and And he had one of those edits that one of the Twitter people does for all the kids, because that's a thing that people do. And half of his jersey is Vagos Prep, and the right half of his jersey is South Carolina, and parts of both of those words are in the jersey, and I'm a 12-year-old, so you can figure out what happened.
I think you have to be a 12-year-old to find this funny.
Or you just look at my Twitter feed.
Good Lord, this is stupid. I mean, this is good. This also makes for some great audio.
this is the joys of live radio. An unedited podcast.
sometimes edited if one of us drops the call.
Well, yeah, that's about the limits of it. That's like the one instance. That totally derailed my point about the ACC coaches, and I don't even care.
That's fine. Spending a little bit more time on Tulane, because you brought up a great point. Willie Fritz was an inspired hire, a non-traditional hire. One that I was actually surprised that Fritz made, just because not that Tulane's a bad job by any means. I actually think that other than being a private school, I think that there's actually a lot of advantages to that job. But yeah, I think Fritz... Are you giving him 3 years, do you think, before we really see this thing fully operational? I mean, it looks like the brand is getting back on track. It seems like the on-campus stadium is going to help them get back on track. It looks like, overall, Tulane is definitely a program on the rise, even if it's going to take maybe, you know, some more time before we see the full kind of results of that.
I think you have to give him some time. I mean, it's a tough league. Tulane's coming from, I mean, aside from that, like, random bowl game the year we played them, they're not coming from a lot. They have the new campus stadium. They're installing an entirely new offensive system. I think you have to give them at least three. Otherwise, I don't think Tulane can be in a position where they're just cycling through coaches like that. So and Fritz obviously has a resume. It's not like he's, you know, this upstart guy who had one nice year as an OC or something. Like, he's a guy who's a proven head coach. I think they got to give him, you know, at least four, unless things are like an abject disaster.
Yeah, I think he gets... Sorry, I was reading the comments underneath this stupid tweet. Did you read the first one? This is just the dumbest... This was the dumbest podcast before, and now it's just turned into the worst podcast.
I can't wait till there's one UConn fan who decides to listen to this and realizes that we're talking more about this recruit's Photoshop than we are about the team which beat Houston last year.
Oh, Christ. I'm crying over here. It's stupid. Yeah, well, while we're at it, why don't we talk about UConn, I guess.
We have to.
Now, we kind of have to, just because, like, we talked about USF a little bit. We are facing UConn. People fashion this to be a little bit of a toss-up game. I fashion it to be a game a little bit more in Syracuse's favor. I think that it's not that UConn got fat on bad teams last year, but they certainly didn't overly impress other than the Houston game. UConn also hasn't really recruited well since Diaco arrived. I don't know if that's really... It's not necessarily a knock on Diaco. He's obviously done a very good job in game coaching, but I think as far as, you know, getting talent in the door, that's going to catch up to them eventually. I don't know if that's this year, but it's going to be very hard for them to surpass the 6 wins from last year, based on the schedule and just based on, you know, again, it's the overall incoming talent. Obviously, we've got to head over to Paul Zarf for a little rendezvous with our old conference rival. But yeah, I've got us winning that game, but I would put a lot of spotlight on UConn in general as just a bit of a case study because, you know, if UMass is ever going to become anything more, it's going to have to look to UConn to kind of get that blueprint. And I just don't see it. You know, that stupid Fiesta Bowl at the side, which was just a product of the Big East being awful. I don't see how UConn really turns into more than it is right now under Diaco or anybody else.
Yeah, I think this is a big year for Diaco. Obviously, last year he pulled off. I mean, that was a really, really good coaching job by him last year. No one expected him to be that as good as they were that early in his tenure. I don't know how much longer he can afford to kind of stay there, because like you said, recruiting there is just such an issue, especially when it's, I mean, just as someone who played in Connecticut, like there is more of a spotlight put on the top in-state talent in Connecticut, even if that's only like 5 or 6 kids every year. And because of where UConn is now, it's becoming very hard for them to get those guys in-state. There were not a lot of favors done by the Randy Edsall administration in that regard. He did not put a big focus on UConn kids, or Connecticut kids, rather. Although I'm not sure how much that's still carrying over, but I know there were like a lot of hurt feelings among the Connecticut high school football coaches. But anyway, it's interesting because they have a tough schedule. Just look at that mid stretch. Obviously, we and Virginia are both rebuilding, but neither of those is anything close to a easy win for them. Virginia, should be improved. We should definitely be improved. Oh, and they have Navy at week 2, which I kind of missed. So you have Navy, Virginia, Syracuse, at Houston, Cincinnati, at South Florida, until then you have UCF. UConn, if they split those games, they'll be thrilled, and that's just a really tough stretch. So I think they just need to be gunning to get back to a bowl. Six wins might be like that. That might be one of those cases where 6 wins is actually way better than it looks, considering what UConn is and the talent gap that they'll have with even most AAC teams.
Yeah, I mean, how far, I guess, do you think that 6 or 7 wins is kind of as good as it's going to get for UConn? And also, how much longer do you think Diaco's there?
Unless they find a way to start like competing for the top kids outside of Connecticut and like going after top kids in like Pennsylvania or New Jersey, which it doesn't seem like they're super involved in right now. I can't see the ceiling being a lot higher outside of like that one really like lucky year. And then with Diaco, I mean, if he keeps on winning, I can't imagine, you have to jump to a job eventually. So I'm almost surprised he's still there. But coaches seem to be moving at different paces now than they used to. But if he continues to put them in bowl games, people understand what that means coaching at UConn, especially coaching like he rebuilt UConn. It wasn't like Pastelloni left him in a very good spot. So I don't think he'll be there for much longer unless he has like one of those weird 10 years where he doesn't quite bottom out but doesn't do anything to inspire a lot of confidence from outside programs. But, he also has, like, that Notre Dame background. It's not like he was actually a pretty big-name hire for them when it happened. He's a guy I really wanted when we ended up hiring Schaefer. So that might still carry him through, even if UConn doesn't really take it to the next level.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate summary. I think that's a good way to end on UConn, who again is on the schedule, and that's cool for them. And hopefully we beat them, because I don't really want to hear about it if we don't.
Yes, please beat UConn. I can't deal with that if we lose to UConn. And that's on the table. UConn's pretty good, so hopefully we don't have to worry about that in September.
Much agreed. All right. Dan, any other parting thoughts?
Nope. Roll Van Vagos prep.
Also, side note, the last hashtag on this tweet is "we cocky," and I'll just leave that here.
That South Carolina's like recruiting buzz thing, like,
and but yet for here it goes so much further.
Oh, so good. Everyone enjoy that tomorrow morning.
Indeed. That was Dan. I'm John. Thanks for listening to Troy Noon's and Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk. And talk to you next week.
Have fun with this one, everyone.